You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome to the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded July 6, 2024. Today, we're going to deal with a misleadingly obscure topic. I've dealt with it in pieces before, but I want to deal with someone who, in my first book, The Third Rome, I said was an anti-czar, and I still hold to that today, that he was an oligarch. And so when I say Tsar Vasily Shuisky, who died in 1612, the Tsar, it has quotation marks around it. I've said before that nationalism has two components. The first is the theory philosophy itself, and the second is the history of any specific nation that you're talking about. The time of troubles and the rise of Tsar Vasily Shuisky are very specific to Russia. You don't find a lot of parallels with this stuff. It's a bizarre story, but there's some purpose behind it. The modern monarchy that really came into its own in the 19th century in Russia was founded, for better or for worse, because of Shuisky and his eventual fall. In fact, the rise of the House of Romanov came right after him. He ruled Moscow, or pieces of Russia, from 1606 to 1610. You'll see his name listed in some lists of Russian monarchs. However, I think the bulk of people who know reject him as a legitimate czar. Almost every aspect of his story is bizarre. But this is what had to happen in order for the Romanovs to eventually take over. Again, for better or for worse. This was a revolutionary trauma to the Russian Empire at the time. But when I say the time of troubles, this is a political and economic crisis, starting with the death of Fyodor I, who died in 1598 and didn't end until 1613 with the election of Mikhail Romanov. Now, I have defended Fyodor I, who is the son of Boris Godunov, but his death ended what we might call the Rurikid dynasty. And that's a whole separate issue to what extent that's even real. But he certainly was a high-ranking aristocrat. So, after Fyodor's death, you have, again, something very specific to Russia, a series of fakers, pretenders. They're more than just usurpers. They're false monarchs claiming the title of Tsar. Making matters worse, in the midst of all this was an intense famine from 1601 to 1603, which killed a huge number of people. And it didn't take long after Fyodor's death that huge chunks of Russia were occupied by foreigners, Poland in particular. This is an analysis of political fraud. This is an analysis of Russian history, specifically Russian history. It's a little bit on the obscure side, but as far, if you care about Russia at all, it is extremely important. It's this trauma that led to the adoption of the new right, that led to the Petrine Revolution, and on and on. Not directly, of course, but most certainly paved the way, because for the first time in a long time, you had a severe succession problem. Vasily Shuisky came from a legitimate and ancient noble lineage. How many times have you heard me say, either in speech or in writing, that one of the main purposes of a monarchy is to prevent an oligarchy from taking over? An oligarchy is similar to a plutocracy, and that is the rule of wealth, but it's the rule of a small number of wealthy people for their own interests. Otherwise, it's an aristocracy. He was recognized under Tsar Boris, which I have a separate lecture on. He was recognized for his military acumen, and even the Tartars recognized his ability as a negotiator. So this man was not, yes, he was an oligarch. I don't believe he was good for Russia at all, except as a negative example. And he did, though, his reign, his rise and fall, is connected with the phony Dmitri's. Now, Boris Godunov, we'll talk about this in one second. Boris Godunov died in April of 1605. Vasily supported his son, Fyodor. He was on the throne, supported him, but there was someone else. And this is, again, another bizarre story. The Tsaremitz Dmitri was a young boy, allegedly killed himself in an epileptic fit. I mean, accidentally. From the Apanage Principality of Uglik. The reason that they're called false Dmitris is that they claim to be this young man. Fyodor Godunov was in a very difficult position. And Vasily, being a Machiavellian, even though he was the first one to report that Dmitri was dead, Dmitri, by the way, the last heir of Ivan the Terrible, through his last wife, so even that legitimacy is iffy, but he clearly, people claiming to be him, attracted a lot of support. So depending on when he needed this claimant to the throne, Dmitri, sometimes Shuisky would say that he accidentally killed himself, and others that he miraculously escaped. Now, the old rite, Menaeon, or the list of the saints, has him included. I mean, this kid, regardless of what may have happened, was very significant. Because this kid was the last son of Ivan the Terrible, he was a threat to anyone, including Boris Godunov. He sent Shuisky to investigate into this. This was in May of 1591. This kid died under mysterious circumstances. Shuisky said that he had killed himself, not suicidally, but there were plenty of rumors that he was murdered by Boris. It's that story that led to these imposters. Shuisky, eventually, once the first man claiming to be Dmitri rose and was fairly popular, although we'll see here in a minute, it was under very strange pretense, Shuisky said this was the real Dmitri, despite having said in the past that the boy accidentally killed himself. Tsar Fyodor himself was eventually murdered. Vasily Shuisky was a Machiavellian. He was an oligarch, always conspiring. He only had permanent interests, not permanent friends or enemies. Sometimes he would support the false Dmitri, sometimes he would reject them. And whether it be Fyodor or the false Dmitri the First, who did rule for a short time, Shuisky was always scheming against him. 1605, July, the false Dmitri actually succeeded in taking Moscow, and he needed someone like Shuisky. This man was obviously an imposter, but Vasily was favored by him. To the Grand Sobor, he was a senior advisor. The wife of the false Dmitri, an infamous woman named Marina Nishek. We'll talk about here in a minute what the Polish connection was here and the Vatican's connection here. Suski ultimately turned on false Dmitri I and helped organize the Moscow Rebellion in 1606. That's when the first false Dmitri was killed. Dmitri was able to garner a tremendous amount of support to him. Suski was one of the few eyewitnesses to Dmitri's death. And it was right after that Vasily Suski was proclaimed the monarch. He was a contender, but being a Machiavellian oligarch, he was a terrible choice. He was not elected like Mikhail was. He simply took power because he saw a vacuum. And it was the Metropolitan of Novgorod that oversaw the coronation. No one was less secure than Tsar Vasily. One of the ways that we know he's an oligarch is that he was the first in Russian history to lay out some variation of a constitution. Now, when I say constitution, I'm talking about oligarchy. The rich using the state to protect their property, to destroy their competition, and to destroy their enemies is a very real aspect of Russian history. That's what a constitution is. It's the creation, more or less, of a republic. And one of the signs of that is that the property of the oligarchs is legally guaranteed and cannot be despoiled except by a judgment of other oligarchs. Now, once Vasily was crowned, he changed his mind again on the Tsarevich Dmitri issue and brought his relics back to Moscow and then proclaimed to everyone that Boris Godunov is the man who murdered Dmitri. And it was here that he was canonized as a martyr to essentially Machiavellianism with the support of the ultimate Machiavellian. One of the first acts of Tsar Vasily is to create a republican system, more or less. Whether it be a criminal case or a civil case, only other elites can condemn an elite. And they met in the Boyar Duma. And it's only from a verdict of that Duma, the parliament, that any other oligarch could be stripped of his wealth. He promised, Vasily did, that he's not going to permit false and hidden denunciations and have some kind of a systematic way of investigating these things. The Duma's role here was more sharply defined. So in the process, he created two courts, the court of the Tsar himself and the court of the Tsar along with the oligarchs. The concept of disgrace is when an arrogant oligarch was removed by the Tsar. And the claim is that this was an arbitrary circumstance of the monarch. But even in terms of disgrace, of disgracing or censuring an oligarch, only the Duma was capable of doing that. So the sovereign isn't really judicial power anymore. He's purely an executive one. In other words, disgrace, all of these things needed justification, but that justification can only come through the Boyar Duma. All of these obligations assumed by Tsar Vasily were aimed exclusively at protecting the personal property of the elites, of the plutocracy that every society has. At a minimum, though, it's interesting because this is the first time there was some definition, at least in the Moscow era, of the concept of a separation of powers. And we all know there's only one power, and that would be the Boyar Duma. And that's what would limit the monarch's power. It limited the monarch's power only in judicial matters as related to individuals. Back in the Kievan era, the way that elites swore an oath or gave their word was to kiss the cross. It was taken very seriously. It was the oath of oaths. Tsar Vasily tried to return it. Moscow didn't have this tradition, but Kiev did. He tried to bring it back almost as a form of personal power. And it came from the Boyar Duma in the first place. This was not a custom in the Muscovite state. The kissing of the cross idea seemed to be a revolutionary idea. That this could be personal, not institutional. The opposition to this was found in the Zemensky Sobor. This is a far broader gathering of members of the state, from royal family all the way down to the peasantry. So you have the Tsar, you have the oligarchic Boyar Duma, and the Sobor. And this is not even talking about the Synod at all. But because this cross-kissing idea almost eliminated the Duma, and the Tsar can make personal contracts and arrangements with others through the deadly serious kissing of the cross as the seal of a contract, so to speak. He then turned to the Zemensky Sobor, not the Boyar Duma. Typical of him, he goes from one thing to another. He was what most people would call a party man. He was a Boyar Tsar. He sought to use the Zemensky Sobor, which didn't seat all the time. It was only temporary, against the Boyar Duma. That was more or less permanent. This was a way to turn away from limiting his own power. To some extent, it was a deal with the elite. It was a way of sharing power, but not just with the oligarchs. The Sobor was far more representative. So he went from trying to use the oligarchs to gain power, and once he gained it, used a different set of oligarchs to shut them down as a balance between the Sobor and the Duma. And the elite began to see Boris as a liar, and that ultimately the Boyar Duma was essentially a Supreme Court, lack of a better phrase. Now, Ivan the Terrible, Boris Godunov, you have the traditional limitations on the Russian monarch having nothing to do with any contract with anyone else, but of course the canon of the church, not to mention the tradition of the crown itself. The Boyars hastened to eliminate that so-called tyranny to protect themselves from what Ivan the Terrible did. Ivan the Terrible smashed the oligarchy in order to strengthen the crown. That's why he was a good man. That's why his reign, very long reign, was successful. Now, a lot of my information here comes from the famous historian Kluchevsky, and to some extent Soloviev. And they both say that the cross-kissing idea, this oath, is revolutionary. The formally limited supreme power using one faction against another. Once he got into power, he became a very different man. And this was encouraged by the fact that you had frauds and warfare everywhere after the death of Fyodor. While he was not elected, Tsar Vasily proved his oligarchic background by claiming to be a limited monarch. Now, this whole process goes like this. There were three elements, three prerogatives of the monarchy previous to this that Shuisky removed. The first I've mentioned already, the concept of disgrace. The Tsar's disfavor and all that meant was no longer at his personal discretion. Number two, again, the confiscation of property. And the protection of relatives not involved in any kind of crime or treason or whatever it is. the clan responsibility was abolished. And finally, any denunciation had to be investigated by a specific institution, by a specific bureaucracy. And some of those prerogatives, really, you take them together, and it is the full prerogative of the Russian monarch. And that's why this was a revolutionary ideal. We're in the midst of the time of troubles, where there was no obvious legitimate ruler. Ivan the Terrible was such a towering personality. The boyars never wanted that to happen again. That's what the whole opportunity was. It was a way to challenge oligarchic rule in Russia. And one of the things that the oligarchs sought to increase was serfdom. The turn of the 16th, 17th century, Russia saw a gradual intensity of serfdom. It was far looser before, and it really reached its apogee in the 18th century. During the reign of Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible, he sought to alleviate the lot of the peasantry, of course, is the core of the empire. I've talked about St. George's Day before, the second St. George Day in November, where once your debts are paid, the peasant can leave his former feudal lord. That was banned under Czartoryski. It actually was started under Fyodor, but it was institutionalized under Czartoryski. So while he wants to limit his own power as a way to approach the other oligarchs, he wants to make private property, including peasants, as unlimited as possible. Now, false Dmitri, there were several of them. There's the first and the second. The first one was from 1606, the second from 1607. These are largely Polish intrigues. Now, the uprising I've already mentioned, 1606, the first false Dmitri was overthrown. And that's the coattails of which is where Wasily Szewski was crowned. The rebel movement against him came from the smaller landowners. There was the Cossack Rebellion by Bolotnikov, which he fought, which was a legitimately populist movement. And in early spring of 1607, Szewski was already in the process of suppressing any rebellion, uniting the handful of supporters that he had. And one of the ways they did this, after the death of the first false Dmitri, was his new law code. And that was adopted on March 9th, 1607. I mentioned Bolotnikov because peasant uprisings led by Cossacks were becoming the norm, both in the oligarchic rule in Moscow, and these people were mostly very pro-Ivan the Terrible, and the fact that you really didn't have a strong central authority in Moscow anymore. So when this code, this new law code, which may or may not have ever even come into effect, they talk about the Bolotnikov rebellion, the strife, the violence, the devastation. And this was the code that completely abolished the St. George Day rule, welding the peasant to the feudal lord. Anyone who accepts a peasant who pays his debts, takes advantage of the old law, and goes to another lands, is fined. This is because oligarchy demanded the sacrosanct nature of private property, which is what Ivan the Terrible set himself against. Let's go back to the false Dmitri and Marina. I mentioned that this is Polish intrigue. Well, it's also Roman Catholic intrigue. You have three popes. You have Clement VIII, who died in 1605. Leo XI, who died that same year. And, of course, Paul V, who died in 1621. The pope was extremely pleased with the false Dmitri phenomenon. The pope wrote letters, one to the false Dmitri, another to Marina, and actually another one to Marina's father. The pope, Clement VIII, wrote this to the pretender, the first false Dmitri, once he got married in the Latin Rite to Marina. We are undoubtedly confident that just as you wish to have children for yourself from this chosen woman, born and raised in a pious Catholic family, so you also wish to lead the peoples of the Muscovite kingdom, our most desired children, to the light of the Catholic truth, to the Holy Roman Church, the mother of all the other churches. For the peoples must necessarily imitate their sovereigns and leaders. Believe me, you are destined by God so that under your leadership the Muscovites will return to the bosom of their ancient mother, who stretches out her arms to them. And you could thank the Lord for the mercy shown to you in no other way than by your diligence and zeal so that the peoples subject to you will accept the Catholic faith. Now, this was the role, or at least one of the broader European roles, of the first false Dmitri, claiming to be the boy, the last heir of Ivan the Terrible, who accidentally killed himself years earlier. This is what the false Dmitri, who the at least the first one, took over and was going to do. The Pope expressed this marriage, Marina, to the false Dmitri, that this was a boon to Catholicism. And the whole purpose of both Polish and Vatican support of the false Dmitri, at least the first one, was to do precisely this. And even the letter to Marina's father, and this Marina, Nyshek, is just, you know, she followed wherever power was. The point was to incite the population to Catholicism. And there's no mention of the unions. Remember, 1595 was the imposition of the uniate in the Polish Empire, of the uniate church in the Polish Empire. So we're right in the midst of this huge missionary movement by the Pope of Rome, in this case, using the Polish Empire. And in fact, the Pope said in a letter, February 11, 1606, this was a promise made to Clement VIII, that we're not going to support you unless you swear that you're going to subordinate Russia to the Roman throne. The letters went through the Jesuit order from Rome to Russia. And the Pope said in this letter of April 10th, we are now confident that the Apostolic See will make a great acquisition in those places, meaning Russia, during your wise and powerful reign. Before you is a vast field. Plant, sow, reap everywhere, bring springs of piety, buildings whose tops would touch the heavens. Take advantage of this convenience of the place, and like a second Constantine, be the first to establish the Catholic Church on it. So what this comes down to is that they were going to use the chaos of the time of troubles to pretend to have a monarch, the false Dmitri, pretend to convert to Orthodoxy, and slowly, just like in the Polish Empire, bring people into Catholicism. So the whole Nyshek family continued to press the first false Dmitri, who will take Moscow for a while, to keep his promise. Now, there's a letter, and again, I got this from Gluchevsky's book. Here is something that, allegedly, the first Tsar Dmitri said in his letter to the Pope of Rome. I've thought it all out. I ordered all the cannons to be taken out of the city, that is, Moscow, as if for military fun, and gave orders that on the following Sunday, May 18th, all the Poles and Lithuanians will go out, supposedly to watch the shooting, fully armed, and I myself will go out with all the boyars and nobles who would be unarmed. And as soon as they start shooting from the cannons, and they, you know, salute, the Poles and Lithuanians will immediately attack the boyars and kill them. I even appointed who was to kill which one. Next Sunday, I must certainly kill all the boyars, the best nobles and the boyars' children, and the heads, the centurions, the riflemen, the peasants, anyone who will stand with them as the cannons are shooting their salute. Having done this, I will immediately order Roman churches to be built, but I will not order singing in Russian churches. I'll do everything I swore to the Pope of Rome, etc. There's people who claim that this is a forgery. It's a little harsh. I'm very suspicious. But even if it's not genuine, it is the Russian point of view as to what the false Dmitri, the pretender phenomenon, really was. But the older, you know, Solovyov, 19th century, early 20th century historians took this as real. The boyars were going to allow someone like this, or even a member of the Polish royal family, to take the throne so long as they become Orthodox. But this conversion would have been a very, very weak one. But even the brief rule of the Tsar, of the false Dmitri, there were plenty of attacks on Orthodox churches. And the Polonization of this movement was made very clear. And that's the Moscow uprising that I mentioned a little while ago. And that's the uprising that took place, led by Shuisky, that led to Dmitri's death. The false Dmitri had established Patriarch Ignatius, who was then deposed. And there was a synod where it was the concept of baptism and conversion was discussed, because Marina and the false Dmitri movement was willing to be confirmed but not baptized. They only anointed her and allowing the sacrament of communion, the sacrament of marriage, to come directly out of that. Ignatius, however, supported the false Dmitri and accepted this. Ignatius' rule was only lasted a few months. But this is why the issue of baptism was so important. The Poles were not willing to be baptized, but they're willing to go through the anointing ceremony with the chrism. And this is extremely important. There was a reason she didn't want to be baptized. She could go through the other stuff and kind of laugh it off, but the full baptism and everything that entails was out of the question. And when the false Dmitri set up his own hierarchs, the first thing they did was to claim that you don't really need baptism. Metropolitan Saint Gamagin of Kazan was elected patriarch in 1606. Shuisky was losing popularity once he took over after the fall of the first false Dmitri. That's when you had some oligarchs saying, we want Vladislav IV on the throne. That's the son of the Polish king. But that was a huge problem because he was Polish. The Tsar's army was defeated by the false Dmitri, false Dmitri's forces, and he brought in German advisors, and he actually put out a whole military code. The time of his consecration, Shuisky was 54 years old, and universally, including in Poland, seen as a Machiavellian. Not without ability, of course. But this is why it was so important for the kissing the cross idea. And this is a quote directly from the era. He allowed the cross to be kissed on the condition that he would not put anyone to death without condemning them by a true judgment with his oligarchs or boyars. Shuisky wanted to give the impression that he was elected by the council, but of course, no election ever took place. The only reason that Shuisky ever had any support or respect in Moscow was because he was involved with overthrowing the false Dmitri. Muscovite armies haven't been defeated by him, the Cossacks, and even Polish regulars who invaded the country with him. This is why it's called the Time of Troubles. Vasily lived in fear, as your typical Machiavellian will. The provincial elites, the clashing between the Zemensky Sobor and the Duma. Ultimately, he was only recognized by a handful of people. There was a tiny group of people who proclaimed him on Red Square, on the basis that he had risen against the imposter. Now, you have plenty of people who will say that that quote about killing all of the boyars from false Dmitri, that that was in fact forged by Shuisky. But either way, this is a watershed in Russian political history, given the limitations that I mentioned already. I mentioned St. George's Day. And when that was repealed, and peasants were now permanently under their lords, that's where Bolotnikov came from. And in the process, the second false Dmitri. The Tsar again, they were defeated all over the place. The Tsar and his government were almost locked in Moscow. And Bolotnikov's people, along with False Dmitry II, set up shop in a place called Tushino, a camp that became an alternative, almost a capital in exile. It had its own hierarchy and everything. The Poles fought on the side of False Dmitry II, and Marina Minashek said that the False Dmitry II was, in fact, my husband. Yes, he miraculously escaped being killed by Shuisky. Of course, she was lying, but that's the nature of these specifically Russian issues at the time. She technically was crowned Tsarina, and when her husband was killed, she fled to Tushino. And the second False Dmitry was known as the Tushino Thief. But by 1608, you know, less than a year later, Shuisky, whatever control he had, which is maybe only a tiny part of Moscow, had fallen to pieces. This is when Tsar Vasily, in desperation, went to Sweden, King Charles IX. Remember, you have a Polish invasion, this huge growth in Polish power, Polish-Lithuanian power. The Swedes weren't going to stand by for that. In fact, Shuisky promised huge territorial concessions if they would assist the Tsarist government against the Poles. Someone who came out of this, a member of the Shuisky family, Prince Mikhail Skopin-Shuisky, was a very talented commander. And he was the only reason that there was any defeat of the Tushino movement. Tsar Vasily had absolutely no personality. He really didn't have people around him. So there was a Russo-Swedish army that took city after city. The popular movement was against the pretender, not in favor of Shuisky. The fight against Tushino began by the end of 1609. The Tushino camp was removed. And that's when the West laid siege to the Trinity Sergius Monastery. This was a Polish matter. Not too long before that, False Dmitry II defeated Vasily's army. And he was heading to Moscow. And that's ultimately where the Tushino camp came from, because it wasn't that far from Moscow. One of the leaders of the Tushino movement was a Cossack hetman named Rozhinsky. And he was the one who was put in charge of the defense of Tushino from Tsar Vasily. The de facto commander was Hetman Rozhinsky, and his plan was to blockade Moscow to create starvation. One of the things that the Poles did at Tushino was steal from local peasants. In fact, they quadrupled serfdom so as to impose labor dues for actually building this city. And a populous city grew up in Tushino. The peasants were stolen from. They engaged in forced labor. But once it looked like they were doing well, and Tsar Vasily didn't have support and or no victories, this is where you had mass defections from Moscow to the pretender. The pretender even had his own Boyar Duma. The court there in Tushino was organized on the Muscovite court. They used some nobles, the Tretyakov, the Stupov, Chicherin, Andronov. These were some of the elites that had defected from Moscow. Many of the merchants, by the way, who had worked under Shuisky at some point. And anyone who had a problem with Shuisky was a lot of people then realized that the pretender was the lesser of two evils. But even Roman Ruzinski, as I mentioned, the hetman, wasn't really from the Cossack forces, but he did call himself hetman. The leader of the Zaporozhian Cossacks was Ivan Zarudsky, who was, by the way, a Pole by birth, a Polonized Ukrainian, really. And he was, you know, given a high rank in this movement as well. As I mentioned, Marina already had shown up there. But the minute it looked like Trzcina was going to do well, didn't last long, you had the mass apostasy of Russian elites to Trzcina. Now, Marina secretly married the second false Dmitry just for her own sake, while in public saying, oh, this is the same person as my husband. Trzcina even had its own patriarch, Orthodox patriarch, and that was Filaret Romanov, the father of Tsar Mikhail, who would be elected as the first Romanov afterwards. Filaret was not just patriarch under Trzcina, but he was eventually, in a prisoner swap, he was freed and remained in that position under Vasily Suski. Filaret did not object to the election of the Polish prince Vladislav, but just that he accept Orthodoxy, which really wasn't saying anything. He was arrested by the Poles in 1611. He was released, and he arrived in Moscow in 1619. We're talking about quite a bit later on. Despite the fact that the false Dmitry had showered him with favors, he became a very powerful man in Moscow anyway. And you had plenty of families who would work both sides. They had one part of the family in Moscow, the other side of the family in Trzcina. And this constant betrayal began to sink into the elite mind. Now, Soloviev says, this Trzcina camp, it wasn't the Poles that were the problem. It was the Russian defectors who had nowhere to run if they failed. They considered Suski's supporters as personal enemies. It was only because the Trzcina camp was so bad and tyrannical. It's the only reason that Suski ever was taken seriously at all. And the Cossacks in particular were very furious at Muscovite control. Tremendous destruction. By the fall of 1608, the massive flight from Moscow became a huge hemorrhage because it was the Poles that had issued a huge defeat of Suski's forces. And that's when they laid siege to the Trinity Sergius Monastery. That's also where the famine began. And Tsar Vasily was caught up in a lot of that. And there were coups, attempted coups, by 1610 to get rid of Suski. There were riots everywhere. Many of the Polish mercenaries were not being paid. Same thing goes for the Swedes. But the Trzcina movement, which was seen widely as Polish, was simply a gang of robbers. And the thieves, the Poles, had taken control of a huge portion of the country. We're talking about Yaroslav, Kostroma, Vladimir, Suzdal, Galicia, Pskov, 22 major cities in total submitted to the false Dmitry. And this is why you had this hemorrhage of oligarchs from Moscow to Trzcina. As I mentioned, Suski will eventually make an alliance with Sweden, given how rapidly Poland was expanding. And this was the only reason that the Trinity Sergius Monastery was no longer put under siege. This is also yet another Polish invasion, given the Swedish alliance, and Sigismund III invaded or put the city of Smolensk under siege. Those at Trzcina were actually quite opposed to this movement. They considered the country largely theirs. We're at the cusp of victory. Why are you attacking the country now? But there were commissioners and ambassadors sent to Trzcina asking for assistance because Poland really didn't have a standing army. They had confederations of oligarchs. The pretender's attempt to remind himself that he is this leader, that he is a legitimate monarch, was rebuked right into Shino itself. In 1609, False Dmitri II attempted to escape to Shino with about 400 Cossacks. And he was caught and arrested. He did escape in December of 1609 to Kaluga with a handful of Cossacks. And actually, they were quite happy to be rid of that man. So it could be, in fact, a Polish movement against Moscow. Maria Szek fled the area once her husband fled and eventually went back into Poland. This hemorrhage of elites eventually came to an agreement with the Ticino rebel movement, Polish movement. And really the only concession that they were asked to make was that the Polish monarch, whoever's installed, Vladislav or whoever, will become Orthodox. And again, only permitting the confirmation, what we, you know, the Romans call confirmation, or the blessing with the chrism. But despite these surface victories, the situation in Ticino, the alternative capital, was starting to fall apart. Because you had troops now loyal to the false Dmitri, those loyal to Ticino. And when you have Skopin Szuski, as well as a Swedish invasion, there was a huge problem. Riots broke out all over the country because food prices were going through the roof. There were rumors about murdering Szuski. Sigismund III was dissatisfied with Tsar Vasily's alliance with Sweden, etc. I've mentioned that already. So all these plans never, of course, came to fruition. By March of 1610, much of the old Muscovite state had finally been liberated. I mentioned the invasion in 1609 of Russia through Smolensk, and that caused a lot of damage. To the Ticino movement. And it's really Vasily Kluczewski, as I mentioned in his complete course of lectures, Lecture 42, who talks about the intense unpopularity of Tsar Vasily. Any unity was not in favor of Vasily. It was in opposition to Ticino. The fact that Tsar Vasily was dependent on a tiny circle of oligarchs who placed him in power, played with him like a child, was the root of a lot of this. And when Skopin Szuski died young, that's when the coup against Szuski began to pick up steam. And this is when, in 1610, actually July, where Szuski was overthrown. Now, the idea of there being Szuskis in Moscow at all was a problem for Prince Vladislav. But got the family out of there as quickly as possible. Szuski was sent with his brother, Dmitri, brothers, and Ivan to Smolensk once the Poles took it. And Szuski ended up in the Polish capital, and having allies nowhere, was imprisoned by the Poles. He died in prison September 12th, 1612. And his brother died a few days later. Now, why do I tell this story? You know, what is the point here? Well, there's a few things going on. I mentioned these things very specific to Russia. The pretender phenomenon was very specific. Because both false Dmitris, 1 and 2, developed substantial followings. Well, why would this be the case? It's the case because the oligarchs who Ivan the Terrible had crushed had reasserted themselves after the death of Gudinov. The pretender, Szuski, Ticino, this was a reassertion of oligarchic power. That's where Bolotnikov came from, because it was under Szuski that the St. George's Day rule was eliminated in his law code. The very fact that you had this controversy over kissing the cross as his end run around the Boyar Duma suggests that the institutions of the old Tsarist Moscow no longer functioned. So why did this pretender phenomenon come into existence? Well, you have to have the willingness of the oligarchs to accept a faker, the good czar, rather than Shuisky, who was the noble czar, and a man who could claim with some power, especially because he was being supported by an outside power, to be the savior of the nation. It's said that Tsar Fyodor, Boris's son, was very weak. Allegedly, the boyars, even the locals, didn't have any real respect for him. The Swedes seemed to think that that was the case. Boris Godunov eventually took over and crushed the oligarchs. Again, the Boyar Duma had to be resurrected, and this was done under Vasily. Of course, the death of the child Dmitry, and that Tsar Fyodor died childless. This is where Boris Godunov came from, and his son, and then after that came the pretender phenomenon. This was now an elective monarchy, for better or for worse. This wasn't the clear hereditary succession that you had in Moscow up until this point. No one trusted the elites once they went back and forth on the Dmitry issue. I'm not even sure if Dmitry would have had a claim, given that it was not a legitimate marriage at the time, at least if the mainstream was to be believed. But whether it be Boris, whether it be Fyodor, or Shuisky, they lived in fear. The leadership now was distrusted and held in contempt. This is one of the reasons that Ivan the Terrible was so venerated in Russia, then and now. And let alone the terrible famine of 1601 to 1603, which drove food prices through the roof. And there's this superstition that somehow this is a czar's fault. Using these pretenders is how the Russian czardom will be captured. Now, who specifically these pretenders were, there's a lot of theories as to that, but it really doesn't matter. It's a phenomenon. But it's not just a group of weirdos claiming to be the king of Russia. No, they were highly successful. There's a mainstream book, I can't think of it off the top of my head, that claims that the Tsar Dmitry, a false Dmitry, was not a bad ruler. Either way, after the death of Boris Godunov, monarchs came into existence only because one faction of the elite or another supported them. That destroys the continuity of politics. That destroys the trust in the elite of both church and state. The fact that someone like Vasily Shuisky could be elected by such a tiny group of people shows just how narrow these factions truly were. This era began the traumatizing of Russia that can, in turn, as I mentioned, lead to the adoption of the New Right and the Petrine Revolution. We know that Shuisky was an oligarch and the oligarch's czar because of the code that he laid out. It's essentially a Magna Carta. But it all comes down to the Republican idea of the sanctity of oligarchic private property. And he was, at least on paper, willing to limit his own power in their favor. But as a kissing of the cross phenomenon, also specific to Russia, shows that he was quite capable of turning on these people too. And when he was finally captured, Tsar Shuisky had no supporters anywhere. Finally, the elimination of freedom of the peasantry leading to Cossack rebellions is one of the things that allowed the pretender phenomenon to come into existence and someone like Vasily Shuisky to ever be elected. The Poles and Swedes will eventually be driven out of the country largely through popular militias financed by small landowners. The larger landowners, as Ivan the Terrible warned, are the enemy, not just of Russia, but any state where they find themselves, because they're going to do anything they can to protect their investments. These rebellions were, Bolotnikov and others, were absolutely perfect for a pretender claiming to be Dmitry, who survived his epileptic fit and killed himself, to come in and claim to be the Tsar. You didn't have photography, you didn't have tape recorders. It was tough to tell who was who. It's said that Ivan the Terrible was this terrible tyrant. He did the very opposite of Shuisky. I think Boris Godunov was an excellent czar. And whether or not Fyodor was weak, that's a separate issue. Fyodor II. But at least he was perceived that way. Now, the full list of these pretenders, of course, false Dmitry I was probably the most significant. It's claimed to be Grigory Otrepiev. The false Dmitry of Sembor, which kind of was a Toshino, but much smaller in a different place. False Dmitry II, that was a Toshino thief. There's a claim that he was a baptized Jew, Bogdanko. You had another one, rising in Pskov, who had didn't rule at all, false Dmitry III and false Dmitry IV in Astrakhan. So it seems not only, and some of the last two disappeared without a trace, really. It seems that every city and every region had their own false Dmitry. Vasily Shuisky, his Machiavellianism, the Machiavellianism of the Poles, Polish elite, and these pretenders to the Russian throne. They could only have come into existence in very specific conditions, and those conditions, again, specific to Russia, and what really amount to the time of troubles, especially the ending of the dynasty of Ivan the Terrible. Boris Godunov was not a member of that dynasty. Only the boy Dmitry could make any kind of a claim there. Of course, the resurrection of the boyar elite and their war with Moscow, their war with the monarchy, the economic failures, especially the famine. The issue was the ruination of the smaller farms, the real backbone, especially the military backbone of the Muscovite state. And this in turn leads to intense social dislocation. The lack of trust. Because of the St. George Day rule, you had runaway peasants all over the place. It didn't matter whether there was this law code, probably never put into action. The St. George Day rule certainly won. The Opricina did not destroy the rule of law. In fact, it resurrected it. It's because the Opricina was overthrown that someone like Shuisky could ever be elected. Again, Tsarevich Dmitry died under mysterious circumstances in 1591. That was the last member of that family. The Godunovs and the Romanovs were really the only major ones. Poor harvests, etc. And the famine was just deadly. All of this has to come, not to mention you have the papacy and you have the Poles willing to back these pretenders, not because they care one way or the other, if they're legitimately these people or not. They had plenty of mercenaries. They had many Cossacks. And this is what happens when you have a situation of the total lack of trust. I mentioned that the kissing of the cross is anti-institutional. The only thing you have is the faith in your word. Without institutions to enforce contracts, kissing the cross, which violation was total damnation, and people, of course, took that very seriously. That's what held the elite together, for better or for worse. The rule of the first false Dmitry was a Polonized one. Attempts at reform, not so much because anyone cared about Russia, but to gain the support of at least one faction of the oligarchs. I mentioned that when the Ticino False Dmitry II really took off, and militarily they were extremely impressive with the Cossacks at the forefront. Oligarchs in Moscow left in droves, and in fact it became a huge problem. It's one of the things that destroyed Shuisky in general. You don't have to be a nationalist monarch to despise the idea that foreigners have ruled your country now in the capital city. Now, technically, Shuisky came from the Suzdal branch of the Rurik. The Bolotnikov uprising from 1606 to 1607 gave the military reason for a pretender to come into existence and to have its dialectical opposite in the election of Vasily Shuisky. They were both illegitimate, but for very different reasons. Shuisky's position was very curious once Bolotnikov took over. Ivan Bolotnikov was the leader, Cossack. Shuisky was rejected by everybody. Bolotnikov may well have believed that the False Dmitry was real. People wanted to believe it because there was no source for legitimacy anymore. Of course, it wasn't until 1606 that Bolotnikov's troops were defeated. They failed to take Moscow. But they were militarily impressive. The only way that Shuisky was able to gain the military force necessary that was not loyal to him personally was his many concessions to the nobility. That was the only reason he had any support, that he was capable of fielding an army of any kind whatsoever. I should also mention that the Crimean Tartars had crossed the Oka for the first time in a long time. This is why it's a time of troubles. You have every conceivable thing going wrong in a country you could possibly have. This is why it's so significant. This is why I use words like trauma. It's rare that you come across this kind of intense dislocation, but with this very strange, very weird phenomenon of people claiming to be, of all people, the former boy king who somehow was rescued from his epileptic suicide. It's not that Shuisky was illegitimate. Of course he was. Not the False Dmitry. Both of them were illegitimate. They both were. It's that there was no foundation for legitimacy anymore. It was a time where the political thought of the Russian Empire had to completely reorient itself. Russia was lucky in the era of Ivan III, Basil III, Ivan IV. You had a very clear concept of succession. Russia was very lucky in that regard. Now, their luck had run out. I talk about Shuisky because it is what happens when a power vacuum exists and a Machiavellian personality takes over. At no point was Shuisky ever really considered a czar. But by the time the second False Dmitry showed up, he was already tottering. And it was his own friends that removed him from power. And those that remained supported Vladislav as the Russian Tsar. And since he was Catholic, maybe had a phony conversion, most of the country completely rejected him. And the Ticino movement was extremely tyrannical and violent in the local peasantry. So I know this has been a fairly obscure journey into the heart of the Russian mentality, politically speaking, especially when it comes to the monarchy. But I think it's very important. It was a traumatic event, and it helped define the Russian idea from then on. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.